Hello and welcome to a very special Music Ally Focus with me, Music Ally's editor, Joe Sparrow. And in this episode, we're joined by none other than Music Ally's head of insight, our very own Stuart Dredge. Now, we've just published our latest quarterly report, which comprehensively breaks down how each of the big and the mid-tier global DSPs are doing in a spicy report card format. And Stu joins me here to talk about some of the big picture ideas that he's taking away having put this report together. And he's going to answer some questions about those DSPs that everyone who's interacting with the streaming platforms, its users and its economy, that is to say pretty much everybody, will need to be aware of in the near future. So we're going to try and forecast what might happen around things like price rises, the shift away from music to audio, how artists get paid, and of course AI and lots of other bits and pieces. All that coming up. Now, of course, each Music Ally Focus episode analyzes one meaningful music business topic at a time. So this podcast is going to be relatively quick, but a little bit longer than usual. So it should take about the same amount of time as Patrick Bertoletti could eat 200 dozen, yes, dozen, oysters. He ate 34 dozen oysters in 8 minutes in 2012. Now, talking of gobbling down lots of slippery items, let's get down to business and hear all of the analysis on the issues that streaming platforms and everyone interacting with them are facing in 2023 from Music Ally's head of insight, Stuart Dredge. So it's a pleasure, as always, to be joined by our head of insight, Stuart Dredge. Hi, Stu.
Hello. Hello.
Wonderful to have you. Now, listen, we've just published or about to publish the quarterly report, which is a really good snapshot of DSPs, streaming platforms around the world and what they're doing and what's the interesting developments in those spaces. If you're a Music Ally subscriber, you can just go and read it. If you're not a Music Ally subscriber, well, you can listen to this podcast and glean some things from it here as well and go and explore Music Ally's premium content. But what we're going to talk about here, Stu, is a few things that are in relation to the world of streaming platforms right now and what we think are going to be the important things in there on the horizon going forwards. We've got five topics here that we've put together. One is the sort of transition of focus from music towards audio and what that means. We're going to talk about price rises. That's both on the user end paying more and maybe how artists get paid at the other end as well. The changes around user interfaces and AI on DSPs, which a lot of you have probably seen on your streaming apps recently. Direct artist support and what that means about how fans can support artists directly through streaming platforms. And then finally, the sort of mid-tier of streaming platforms that are not the big, big names. And finally, let's have a little dabble around with what Web3 means in there, and because that Web3 technology is living in that space. So let's go straight to the first one, which is the sort of transition, or is there a transition, of music streaming services becoming audio streaming services?
Yeah, well, it just comes out of what we've been writing recently, really, about some of this debate about streaming with, for example, Sir Lucian Grainge at Universal saying about low-quality content or white noise and so on. And also the whole artificial intelligence debate and how AI-generated music is going to take over. And it just is making me, it's kind of sharpening this point for me that we think of things like Spotify as a music streaming service, but it's been very open about the fact that it wants to be an audio streaming, it wants to be a radio competitor. It wants podcasts, it wants audiobooks, and increasingly weaving all this together as well, so that you listen to Spotify for your podcasts and then your music and then your audiobook. And it's somewhere you get all this stuff and live audio, although they've kind of gone back on that. So I think that's the interesting thing. It's bringing this tension where music is competing with other kinds of audio, both for listening time and where there are royalties, possibly for royalties. And it's making everyone feel a bit tense because we're thinking, well, why is my artist's song getting the same royalty as a piece of white noise? Which kind of brings me, it's one of my pet hates. Well, not hates, one of my things that bothers me about this whole discourse is this assumption that, for example, white noise is low quality and not as valuable as music.
Which is actually a hard thing to, perhaps for artists to take on board, isn't it? That they're pouring their heart and souls into these 3-minute songs, let's say, versus a piece of white noise that people listen to go to sleep. But, you know, really, from a user perspective, those two pieces of audio are equally valuable depending on the circumstance, right?
Well, I think this is the thing. It's about the context. So if you can't sleep, or if you have a baby that can't sleep, and you find a white noise playlist that helps with that, it's genuinely life. It improves your quality of life. And so that is really valuable to you that second. And if you pay for Spotify, and one of the reasons you pay for Spotify is you have a bunch of sleep playlists you love. Yeah. So I think it's interesting. It's and I don't mean to say to musicians, your music is less valuable, but it's that tension I see on our side of things, music side of things, where people are saying, actually, yeah, these are music services and music should be the priority and music should be the most valuable content on there. But from the other point of view, from users using these things to listen to all kinds of stuff, and the services see themselves as audio. So I think that's a really fascinating tension. And I think, again, like usual, Spotify gets it in the neck most of all because it's the biggest service. But I think you're seeing everyone. I think you're seeing Amazon Music are doing stuff with podcasts. They're doing stuff with live audio. Mm-hmm. I think this, the kind of cat's out of the bag in terms of these are not just music services. They all see a future where they are the audio service you turn to.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because they've been saying this since day one. I mean, particularly Spotify has been saying, we are the audio platform for streaming. It's not just, we're not a music streaming platform. And everyone kind of went, yeah, sure. But actually now we're seeing that really in effect. They really are, not just Spotify. These platforms are making themselves into audio streaming services. And that audio is anything that is good for the user. And this is a very difficult conceptual shift, isn't it? Where we say that in the realm of audio streaming, right? In that platform consumption format, a piece of white noise, or in my daughter's case, listening to the greatest hits of Elmo on loop for 8 hours a night to get to sleep is, and I will just, Sesame Street Corporation, you can thank me later for the massive increase in royalties you're getting from the Berlin region at the moment. But, you know, those things are hyper valuable, and that sense of value around audio has changed, hasn't it? That's a thing which I think we're going to see come into play more and more next year, isn't it?
I think it's also a slippery slope. If you start saying someone should decide what is valuable and what is not.
Yeah.
Because even within music, like, for example, I'm trying to think of things that will get us cancelled on the internet. Should Oasis' Please. Third album be half as valuable as the first two albums on a quality basis? Should, if you love the Red Hot Chili Peppers and you hate Dua Lipa, should the Red Hot Chili Peppers be valuable more than her? Like, or vice versa. Like, it's one of those things where I think, should a great band who've made a terrible album be paid a lower royalty share for that album? Of course, obviously not. You know, that's not how we do it. But what people on our side are saying is either music should be more valuable, or the other thing I've seen is they say, I think that other content should live on a different service. You know, there should be a white noise sleep service that's separate to music. And that's an interesting idea until you think, but is that what listeners want? So I'm not really coming down on one side of that. That's the big tension this year, I think, is we think of these things as music services, but actually they are audio services, and that's gonna break through up all these kind of discussions.
Yes, and we're perhaps not going to talk about this right now, but obviously that's where AI and generative music comes in to make those waters even muddier. But all of that brings us on nicely to price rises and the concept of what we are paying for music streaming subscriptions. It's clear now that music streaming, paying a music streaming subscription, is not the beginning and end point for music fandom consumption now. Like, we can see the spiking in popularity of supporting artists by buying vinyl and other merchandise and all these things. The consumer now is very used to saying, well, I use this to, maybe they would say, I use this service to listen to music, but I do this to support the artists. Now, I'm not saying that's correct, but that is one way that it's happening at the moment. But the question of whether music streaming should be increased is one that is going to be unavoidable. It's been the same price for a long time. The average price per user has gone down to, I think, below $4.50. If you take the whole world into account, on some of the major streaming platforms. And, you know, we're starting to say then, well, what is the value of music again, aren't we? So what's happening in this space?
Yeah, well, I think there's been pressure for a long time, I think, for the music industry to raise the price of streaming subscriptions. They would like to see it happen. And there's a very often quote, it's not about how often video streaming services have raised their prices versus the $9.99 standard for music streaming. I think what we've seen is actually in the last 2 years, there have been price rises in music. Spotify has done it in different parts of the world. Some of it's been in things like family plans rather than the basic subscription, but it's been happening. But I think where we're at now is that the evidence suggests that adding a dollar or two to a music subscription does not lead to everyone cancelling. And there's a sense that the market can bear slightly higher prices. And that's coming from Spotify said that, like they did, price rates didn't change, Deezer said the same thing. And it's coming from rights holders. So I think we kind of, in an encouraging way, we know now that you can raise a price and people are all going to go off and do free. But what I find interesting is now how that debate is moving on now. And there was an interview or a conference appearance by a Warner Music's financial officer, Eric Levin. And he made this point that he used to work in cable TV. And there, the price would rise every year. Like every year, it would go up a little bit. And people kept subscribing, which is arguably because you can't, you know, it's very hard to not subscribe to cable TV in those days. It wasn't the cord-cutting days. Yeah. But he was saying that should be the case here. Maybe not every year, but we should be thinking about regular price rises, not just we haven't done it for 10 years, so we'll do it once. He wants to see this be an ongoing thing. So I think that's the next debate now. It's not should prices rise. It's going to be they should rise regularly. And that brings on questions like if that's going to be the way we go, well, at what point does that annoy people? And what do we have to give them? What does Spotify have to give them to make it, to sweeten it? So I think we're going to be talking not about should prices rise. We're going to be talking about how often and what is the kind of the quid pro quo.
And this is there's a bigger context around this, isn't there? And you've hinted at it there, which is this is happening in all walks of life. We're seeing prices change in lots of places very rapidly. And as a consequence, I think people are realizing that some things have been artificially cheap for a long time and other things are now are artificially expensive. Across society, people are saying, well, I accept that there's an input and output here. You know, if I can't complain on artists' behalf about them not getting paid enough if over 10 years of me subscribing, I'm paying the same, but living costs have gone up, right? And so there's obviously that. People are understanding that, and I think that's going to be connected to that, isn't it? That there's a sort of wider understanding of, again, it comes back down to value, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. And the other thing I've been thinking about a lot, actually, is this whole idea of the pie. And I know some people get really cross when somebody says growing the pie, because you can't grow pies. Like, you know, you cook a pie, it's as big as it is. You can't make it bigger. You have to make a new pie that's bigger.
Yeah.
It's a bad metaphor. But I think this is all about making a bigger pie of royalties.
I mean, you could bake one pie inside another pie, right, to make it a bigger pie.
Yeah. Or you could have some kind of expanding method.
Yeah, okay.
There's another podcast in this. And, but so here's the thing. If we reverse back a bit, at the height of the debate about the streaming economy and how the model should change and labels are terrible and blah, 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 I think one of the things that labels and their bodies said was, no, the key thing is we need to grow the pie and then everyone wins. That's the important thing we need to focus on, growing the pie. And that's about price rises.
Yeah.
And the implication of that was like, let's stop arguing about who gets what share. Let's make the whole pie bigger than everyone's happy. But I don't think it's one or the other. So I think if we can increase the size of the pie, if we can raise streaming prices, alongside that, there's still going to be a really important debate about how you divide that up. What methodology you use to calculate it, whether it's user-centric or artist-centric.
Or a hybrid, yeah.
So I think the good sign is that it looks like price rises can be done and the sky doesn't fall in. So there's going to be a bigger pie, but that's not going to render irrelevant the debate about how you split that up. That's going to carry on.
Yes. So really, we're looking at a sort of future where we're going to see price rises inevitably, because I think it's inevitable. And we've seen with Apple, for instance, they knocked a dollar onto the monthly fee and the economy didn't collapse around that. But yes, it's again, we talked about this in the first section, this is clearly part of a bigger conversation about what are income streams for artists and how do we support? And it's about understanding that more clearly. Which does bring us on to one of the other topics, neatly, which is direct artist support. So, as you said there, at the moment, from a streaming platform perspective, generally, the main way that artists make money from those streaming platforms. Okay, they can sell tickets and merch, but the main way is from the royalties of the streaming as it's taken place, paid out on a pro rata basis. We know that. And of course, that has been controversial to some people. But the streaming platforms are where people go to listen to music and connect with their artists. So what are the other options there that starts to bring in other perhaps royalty streams that are not traditional streaming royalties?
Yeah, it's a complicated thing, isn't it? Royalty streams that aren't streaming royalties. It's like a puzzle.
I should say revenue streams then, perhaps. Revenue streams, yeah.
But yeah, I think it is. And it is this measurement of like streaming's value to artists is about 0.00 blah per stream. Like in the Eurovision song, the Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes.
A marvelous kind of reference to streaming royalties randomly, which brought work into my Saturday night drinking. but yeah, I think so. This is a really sensitive area, I think, because I think we're moving into an era where streaming is a much better springboard to supporting the artists you love in other ways. Like in the past, I think a lot of it has happened. You stream over here, and then maybe you support their crowdfunding over there, or you buy t-shirts over there, and so on. And like you said, we have had merch and tickets on streaming services, but it has kind of been almost buried in the past. Like it was on the artist profile below the latest songs. There was a thing saying upcoming concerts, or there was a little merch bar. And I think what's happening now, I think we've seen Spotify starting putting merch and tickets throughout its app, including on the non-playing screen. So when you're playing a song, it's like, did you know merch? YouTube and Amazon have been doing a lot of effort in different ways into merchandise and tickets. Like I feel like that whole, you are streaming this artist a lot and you love them and you're following them, here is other stuff you can buy from them. That's taking a step up and making it less kind of low profile. And that's good.
Yes.
But the other thing that's going on, I think, is this idea of what is the layer on top of that that is akin to what you've seen on Bandcamp or Patreon or Kickstarter. How can that, or on Twitch with tips? Mm. So I think we're maybe going to see some proper thinking around how do you bring artist-level subscriptions / direct support / tips to the music streaming economy, which is, I think, like we've seen on Twitch, that there are Twitch streamers who maybe only have like 4,000 regular viewers, and they're making a really good living from that because those viewers pay money because they like them. And it's that whole idea of a very engaged small fan base can create a sustainable career for you. I think the problem we have is when you mention tips to a lot of musicians, understandably, their thoughts turn to busking and begging. And it's like, oh, what? So you're saying that royalties are so low, I've got to beg my fans for cash. Thanks for that. Why don't you just pay me more royalties? And it becomes a sort of point of tension. So I'm kind of interested in what will the streaming services do to try and experiment with these things. So Spotify, for example, has its fan support feature, which was its artist pick, where you could donate money during COVID. They have something. It's been quite local. But I think actually listening to Spotify talk recently, this feels like their next big frontier is like, what's the layer we can add on top of what we do and pay already? And the big questions there, I think, are, do you do it in a way where artists feel comfortable with it? And do you do it in a way where it is as direct as possible? It's not you keeping all the data and keeping artists at arm's length. Like, how do you kind of get out of the way and just connect artists and fans who want to spend money on them in good ways? So I don't really have the answers for that, but I think this is going to be next thing. I know SoundCloud have talked about this. Their new fans thing, for example, is about artists being able to message their top fans, which is not something you've been able to do really in a lot of platforms in the past. So I think we're going to see in the next year, we're going to see some cautious, but maybe quite bold experimentation around, we know that people who love artists want to support them. How can we do that without being too gatekeepery, controlly about it? At least that's
what. Yeah, I mean, I think it's very interesting, isn't it? Because it also sort of says something about the confidence of streaming platforms. And, you know, we know how long it takes when you launch a platform. You know, big tech has to blitz scale and you have to get people on board, and then you have to wait, and then, you know, and then maybe you can start charging, and then you can start bedding in features and all these kind of things. And it is a slow because of the scale of it, you have to go slowly and then you capture the market, a bit like Amazon did. I'm not saying it's right, but that's what people do. It says a lot to for their sort of confidence if they're saying, okay, now you go to an artist page, we're gonna prioritize supporting the artists in these other ways. They feel confident enough to say, yes, the music is here, but also go and connect with them this way, doesn't it? I'm not saying it's a power move, but it does show that they're confident that they can do that. It doesn't annoy anybody, and actually brings an added benefit for everybody, including the fans. That's one thing.
I think it's recognizing that you're part of you're part of an ecosystem. You're not the one place that fans will want to connect to artists. You're not the one place that you go. And you can be a really powerful signpost to other places. But the other thing I think here, where we go back to this idea of them being more than music services, this could be a plus, I think. So if you are YouTube, where you have a whole community of YouTubers, live streamers, gamers, if you're Amazon, where Twitch is part of your system, your corporation, you have these lessons that you can learn from other people. If you're Amazon, you can say, how does fan support work on Twitch? And what can we do with that in Amazon Music? How can we use lessons? And even if you're Spotify, they've got this big community of podcasters, and they've been doing stuff with them with like direct subscriptions.
Right.
And they can take those lessons and go, well, what can we do with this for artists? So I think in a way, the fact that some of our biggest music services do have these other kinds of creators, other kinds of content with these models already working there, that again, I think that could be a boom, because they could say, right, what do we know about how people who love YouTube gamers directly support them? And how can we adapt that for musicians? And how can we tell musicians best practice based on what gamers are doing? There's a lot of lessons, I think, to be taken from these models and elsewhere. And it turns out some of these platforms doing it are under the same roof as streaming services.
It does bring me back to, reminds me of when I spoke to Geronimo Folguera, who's the CEO of Deezer, I think maybe a year or so ago when he started there. And he came from a different tech background than music. And I think it was dating platforms, actually. And he was very, very surprised that as he put it, the use of real estate on artist pages. You've got essentially a fan community there around artists, but they're not served in as well as they could be by features on that page. So and it's interesting that we're getting there quite quickly now, it feels, and with these quite nuanced options as well. And again, you know, we might see some differentiation between the platforms. Like this platform allows you to do this. This one allows you to connect in this way, and maybe certain fans of certain artists will flock to another platform because the fan experience is better for them over there. I mean, we're seeing that already with Twitch. You know, you can stream video on so many platforms, but people love Twitch for these kind of things, but they'll go to YouTube for these kind of things.
One thing I think again is that none of this is like a one thing or the other. So, experimenting with tips, economies, and direct support is not a substitute for raising prices and creating a bigger pie. And it's not a substitute for exploring the models and changing the model so it's divided up more fairly. Like these three things should all be done together. So that's the other thing I think. I think if anyone is saying, we think a tips economy on top of Spotify would be a great thing, that doesn't mean you're saying we don't care about they should raise their prices or we don't care about a fairer split of the royalties. Like all these things should happen and they can all then become a force multiplier for artists. Yeah. So yeah, I think I'm saying if you're saying one of these things is good, you're not saying the others aren't important. I think they're all three of those things are important.
Yeah, and thank you for using more buzzword bingo in force multiplier there. Appreciate that. And now let's talk about, folks, we receive a lot of emails here in Music Ally Editorial HQ. And just as a couple of years ago, NFTs were clogging up our inbox, now it's AI everything, right? So let's try and look past the hype around AI, but we can see immediately that the use of AI in a real sense, in a real beneficial sense, is already being seen in, for example, Spotify's AI DJ. But that is quite a significant shift, isn't it, in how music is being unearthed, delivered, and the opportunities that things like that could deliver.
I think so. So we've been thinking about this a lot, haven't we? Because I think the one thing we've seen this year is this idea of TikTok, the TikTokification of music streaming. So Spotify launched its new homepage, which is a vertical feed of video stuff, and you find things. And then YouTube Music is testing a similar thing, a vertical feed. It's like when everyone said Tinder was the next UI of the future, and it's like swipe left, swipe right. Yeah. And nowadays, it's like got to be a vertical feed like TikTok. And so we're seeing that, which is like everyone's saying, right, TikTok's thing is huge, accessible, a feed of recommendations generated by an algorithm. We've got to do that. But yeah, to move on to AI, TikTok is already on to the next thing. So I think we wrote a story this month about TikTok's, what was it called? Tucker?
Yeah, something like that.
Taco, I think it was. Taco. Yeah. But yeah, basically, it's an in-app chatbot where when you're watching a video, you can flick to this chatbot using a button and ask it questions about the content and have a conversation with it, and it will recommend you other stuff to watch. And it's one of the first big mainstream things I've seen that is taking that idea of ChatGPT, conversational AI, and applying it to entertainment recommendations, where it's like, I'm interested in this, I have this question, and it recommends you stuff to watch.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece a couple of months ago, which was like wondering what this would mean for music streaming. Like, at what point would you have a Spotify GPT bot where getting a stream to listen to would involve you saying, well, I'm in this kind of mood, or I'm interested in this, and have a conversation with the bot, and then it would give you stuff. And I think that's maybe the next thing that everyone will copy from TikTok will be, okay, what is our in-service conversational interface? And obviously this stuff is now like it's happening all over the place. Like there are, you know, AI is going to be chatting to us in all kinds of websites and services. So why would music be any different? And it feels like we have the building blocks in place. Like Spotify now has this AI DJ, which essentially just introduces songs and tells you who is playing and links things.
Yeah.
But why wouldn't the next step for that be for you to talk back to it and it to talk to you? And it becomes a conversation about what you're going to hear next. It's not a radio host. It's a guide. And then you think, well, actually, everyone else has already got these voice systems. We've already got Alexa for Amazon, Siri for Apple, Google. And so we already have this idea of the voice assistant that you speak to say, play me something blah. And now we have these powerful language models that are conversational. So I feel maybe this is going to be the next big leap in how you get music from your music service will be a conversation, which to some people will be anathema. Like people are like, I'm not talking to a chatbot to get music. People will be cross about that. And that's absolutely valid. And you know, you won't have to do it. But I do feel like all this excitement in this part of the year about ChatGPT, conversational AI, I feel like 6 months down the line, we're going to see even more experiments in, well, how can that become the front end, the interface to streaming?
Yeah.
And that's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, it is Taco, T-A-K-O, by the way, I've just checked. Yes, and that's, it's, this is where the rubber, seeing as we're using biz terms here, Stu, this is where the rubber will hit the road with AI. Because putting the words AI in a press release is very helpful to getting attention, but actually, if it doesn't work, people will let it go. It does feel a bit different, doesn't it, in the way that AI is being used to create believably, not human, but believably maybe emotive or connected or understanding systems to connect people with music. And that is not like being a fake, being a fake human. It's sort of just helping make those connections more fluid and dynamic and believable, and that is really what music is about, isn't it? People want to have that context and believe in it and understand it and just get stuck in. And if AI allows that, I'm sure that we will see much more developed versions of all this in the next year, particularly with the rate of progress around AI development, which is absolutely not terrifying.
but it's funny because one of my, like, again, this often gets put in opposition to humans and one of my favorite radio, so there's this idea of streaming competing with radio, you know, which is kind of a sensitivity in itself. One of my favorite DJs is Marianne Hobbs, who's now on in late mornings on Six Music here in the UK.
Yes.
And she would be like, here's this new track, it's brilliant. Like, she's one of those people who will recommend something because she loves it.
Yes, you trust her. You trust her choices, yeah.
If I could have Marianne Hobbs sat in my office all day telling me what's good, because she's so much, that would be my ideal music recommendation service.
Just shouting across the room, Stu, have you, can I just frisbee you this 7-inch single? Yeah,
you must have. But this is why radio is still important to me, even with all the streaming stuff that's going on. But if there's some element of an AI that can perform some kind of function that's in that area, I would also use that. Like, I would also love to be able to chat into a chat box and say, I don't know anything about early house music, and I want to talk to me. Tell me, through how, who it was and what it, who it is to and how it works. And if an AI can do that, I'm absolutely here for it. Even though it would be even better to have someone who knows that stuff talking to you in the flesh as a human. But it's not an either or. So I think this is what, like, I think AIs are going to be capable of doing some of these things that humans do. But it's not they're going to replace them. It's not that they're better than them or worse than them. It's an alternative. Well, that being said, the terrifying thing is, but if the emergence of that technology makes it harder for those humans to earn a living, then it is a concern. Like, that's the yes. That's the problem. It's like something that AI can do that humans do, even though I say, well, I like both. We do have to be cognizant of, like, well, does it make it harder for those humans to carry on doing that? Because, so I don't know. It's all, I'm all muddled a bit, but I think whenever I see everyone getting cross about AI recommendations, I always think if it recommends me something I love, I'm all for it. And it's not going to stop me treating humans as important recommenders too.
And it's interesting, I think, that with, let's talk about Spotify's AI DJ for a moment. They're calling it an AI DJ, not AI radio. So it's about, like, a sort of, it's a bit, not a gimmick, but it's a quasi-human experience between the songs. But if you listen to it, it's good, you know, it's impressive, but it doesn't replace what you've just said of, like, that very niche DJ who you really, really trust and you like their character, and it's spontaneous and all these things as well, and it reacts to what's happening in a human sense in the real time. And on top of that, just to finish that thought, is that, like, the example you gave of saying, hey, I want to know about the early days of house music. And who doesn't, folks? I would recommend exploring that route from a personal perspective. But you can see a future where, you know, a really good AI, and I think we're pretty close to this, that is able to create a believable voice with character, could say, okay, here's a couple of key songs. Then it goes and pulls some information from somewhere as easy as Wikipedia. And maybe there's some sort of payment relationship there as well, so it's creating an income stream. And here's some information from Wikipedia about this topic that we've figured out is correct. And then here, from over here, is a snippet from a podcast featuring someone who was involved in the early days of house music saying something important. We drop that in. And here's another song again that relates to that. Now, that actually sounds like a compelling package. If you're willing to sit down and have that running in the background and it's believable and it works, you can already see that obviously on platforms, streaming platforms, they are using AI technology to create transcripts of the podcast. So if you search for a certain phrase, it will bring up, you know, minute 15, someone's saying this. Well, then they can grab that piece of audio and play it between songs. So that's a compelling package, isn't it? And it's really just about putting those parts together.
There's a startup called Super Hi-Fi. Does exactly that, like, brings in all this audio. So yeah, I think it's true. And I think, like, I thought it was interesting yesterday. I was testing out Spotify's AI DJ yesterday, and it suddenly it's like blocks of five. It goes, right, now you're going to hear some new music from bands you should like. It plays five songs. Then he comes back in and goes, now we're going to play some songs that you used to listen to in the past. And yesterday it went, and now Tina Turner has died, and in tribute to this lead new musician, we're going to play you some of her hits. And it played me five. And at the top of the screen, there's a little tag that says, that shows you why you're being played this song. And normally it's like from your past or your friend's picks or your recent listening. And the tag for this was just a legend. And I thought, that's interesting. Like, that's this AI DJ reacting to a current, like, someone has put that in and said, right, we're going to play everyone some Tina Turner hits then. And that was interesting to me, this idea of this AI DJ being an evolving thing. And, you know, it's one voice at the moment. It could be many voices. You know, it could be your favorite artist's voice being your AI DJ. There's that, once you have this kind of agent, there's a lot of ways it could go. And so if this becomes our interface with these streaming services, chatbots, AI voice DJs, it's going to be really interesting because that technology is developing so fast all the time. And again, the big thing comes when you can talk back to them.
Yeah. And of course, Grimes has created an API for her voice. So you could have Grimes as your radio host. And of course, Music Ally, recently we experimented with turning our daily bulletin, which is our daily subscriber email, which contains the day's analysis and news. We turned that as an experiment using an AI platform called 11. Into an audio version. We cloned the voice of Sarah Sukaran from Music Ally, and she is the voice of that podcast, and it worked really, really well. And you can see perhaps how in the future, you know, you could even have those kind of, like, if you're a music industry person, you could have your favorite songs interspersed with stories from Music Ally's daily bulletin podcast. So you could really have a mix of stuff, couldn't you, that has character and is from all over the place.
There's a story this week we haven't really covered, but floating around about how Spotify is using is developing AI voice clones of some of its popular podcasters so they can read out ads without them having to read out ads.
Joe Rogan AI. And
well, Joe, right? Rogan could be your AI DJ if that's a thing you would want, which I
24/7 Rogan, think about it.
But I think I don't know, the techie nerd in me thinks all this stuff is fascinating. And I also appreciate that some people are really going to not want this at all. And so the key is going to be that you can still get music in other ways. You don't, you know, this isn't the way that music streaming is going to go. It's going to be one option. But I think there'll be people who love it and people who really don't want to do it. And that's, as long as they can both find that path, it's going to be good.
Yeah, good. Right, finally, we've talked a lot about the sort of the top end of the DSPs, the big streaming platforms, because of course we have, they're the big ones. But there's some, let's call them mid-tier ones in terms of their size, you know, subscriber base, but not in terms of their scope. We're talking about Deezer, SoundCloud, Tidal, Napster, those kind of services. Now, of course, in the past we've said, well, what are they going to do? Because what they do is essentially supply the same music as Spotify, so why would you choose them? Well, now we're getting the answer of that, aren't we? So what is happening in the mid-tier? Because it's an exciting space. And what are they doing?
Yeah, I think we've had this idea of people, these companies positioning themselves as disruptors. So you've seen SoundCloud was one of the first to introduce a user-centric royalty system. They're now going big on this idea of artist tools and fan stuff. You've seen Tidal doing some stuff recently around, and they're now part of Block, the financial tech, and they're saying we can do stuff with financial technology, and that's going to be one of our niches. Napster's reinventing itself as a Web3 service. And Deezer is talking about what it can do. And I feel like this is quite healthy. Like when you have a market with three or four big players, which we do globally, it's good if there's some smaller players who are nimble and innovative and disruptive and are pushing the big guys and trying new ideas and doing stuff. But I think the big worry at the moment is it's still really tough. It's still really tough to be a pure play streaming service if you're not owned by a big tech company, or if you're not Spotify, which is the biggest by far. Yeah. And I think we've seen SoundCloud announce another round of layoffs this week. Deezer's financials have made it quite clear that it's not really gaining subscribers in a meaningful way. It's kind of roughly flat year on year. Yeah. There was a big story recently about Tidal and how a judge saying that it's the board of Block couldn't be sued for buying Tidal by share. Saying, even though it looks like it was a terrible acquisition, again, what came out of that was Tidal isn't huge, it isn't growing fast. And so I think this is the problem we have. Like, we have these companies who want to disrupt, but it's still very tough to be that size streaming service. And it doesn't look like, the climate doesn't look like it's suddenly becoming super positive for everyone to make loads of money. So I think that's my question, is like, how long can these disruptors, what's their runway? And if they don't make it long term, do we end up with just four big companies? And does that reduce innovation? And again, if you talk to all those big companies, Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, they would say, we're working hard to innovate. We're putting a lot of money into innovating and doing new stuff. It's not like we're sitting here on our laurels. Do we need these healthy disruptors? And are they healthy enough at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, going back to that Tidal purchase, one of the most interesting things from that kerfuffle around the purchase, the legal kerfuffle, was that Jack Dorsey of Block and Jay-Z holidayed together in the Hamptons, and that's how the purchase came about, which I thought was a fascinating little detail. There's obviously room for experimentation there. These platforms, let's use SoundCloud as an example, they have made these very bold changes. SoundCloud, if you remember, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, were going all in on becoming a Spotify-like streaming platform. And we saw what happened, massive contraction of that business. They completely reformatted the way they are. They focused back on creators, and now they're supplying these services, and it's all connected again. And it actually seems quite interesting, this sort of potential hybrid service that the majors are signing up for there, where artists are paid in a sort of combination of user-centric and traditional streaming payments. So this space is obviously one that allows people to do stuff, probably because they need to find this differentiation to challenge those big players at the top. And the one we didn't talk about there, because they're not really a sort of pure play streaming platform, pure play, you can put that on the bingo card there, Stu, that is Bandcamp, who are a hybrid service, obviously owned now by... it's Epic Games, I think, isn't it? Yeah. And but that, you know, that's a service that is completely focused on supporting artists in a different way. It's not a streaming platform. It's you're buying things from artists and then you get to stream them if you want, but you've bought a thing in the first place. That model has stood out for a while from all these other services because it's not a streaming platform. But we're sort of seeing hybrids of this now, aren't we? And, you know, it's an interesting space. Now, Stu, tell me about one more we haven't spoken about, which is Rezo.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, so if we were thinking, because I think it's not healthy for a market to have no disruptors coming up to give everyone a big fright. So I think you're right, Bandcamp could be one of those. Like, Bandcamp is owned by the company that makes Fortnite, and there's a lot of money there, so it could be big. But yeah, so Rezo, owned by ByteDance, TikTok. And again, to think about social media, the famous cycle, you had Friendster, which was overtaken by MySpace, which was overtaken by Facebook. And then more recently, you've had TikTok.
Instagram, I guess, and then Snapchat, and then TikTok. That's the hierarchy.
And, but you have that thing of, like, TikTok scares all the big social media companies as it rose. And in music, it could be the same. Like, TikTok, ByteDance, Rezo is maybe the one thing where you're like, actually, this new thing, they have the money to really promote it. Like, ByteDance showed the way TikTok got so huge was ByteDance put loads of money into marketing, app marketing. And that's the thing. Rezo has been this service. It's launched in 3 countries, so Brazil, I think, Indonesia, and India. It's been going along, and now they want to expand it globally. It recently stopped having a free tier, which is, I think, part of those licensing discussions. But, you know, if you're going to go global, you can't have a free tier. Yeah. And that's the one thing I see coming through that could shake everyone up, because it's coming from the short video space. So the big streaming services are all going, right, we need to get more like TikTok. And now TikTok sister company is going, right, we're going to build a streaming service from the ground up that's kind of with this. So that's the one thing I see coming. But the real question is, like, to be a proper challenger, to be a big player, you need 80 million paying users. I mean, that's where Apple and Amazon and YouTube are at. Spotify is obviously higher than that. So that's the question, like, can even ByteDance, has it got the resources and has it got the kind of innovation to make Rezo on that level, and how quickly? Because TikTok's rise was huge, but it was a free app. It wasn't kind of trying to pay. But that's the one thing I think where we're watching and saying, if we're going to have a big 5 global services, big 6, then could it be a TikTok music / Rezo thing?
Which would... I don't want to say it will change the game, but it would change the environment significantly, because at the moment, as we know, TikTok is instrumental in the success of songs, short video, let's say, but that means TikTok to a great extent. And, you know, I've spoken to major label A&Rs recently, and they say, you know, we spend a lot of our time looking what's happening on TikTok, and we try and spot potential for what we can inject into a person or artist that is blowing up on TikTok, and we try and grab them as fast as we can and capitalize on it, which is a very different method to previous A&R, and it's not going to be like that forever, but that's what it's like at the moment. But one of the big ambitions is to get the people who are enjoying this song or artist or person on TikTok across to somewhere else where money can be made from that song that is associated with it. And this, of course, closes that loop right down a bit, you know. And an example of this working very well is YouTube Shorts, which is obviously a direct competitor in a sense, and is not, the Shorts element of YouTube is not as big as TikTok, but it is actually very, very big because it's within the biggest streaming platform in the world. And so, you know, and there's some evidence there. We reported on this in a Musical.ly sandbox recently of, you know, artists using Shorts, gaining traction there. And it's, you know, if you want to carry on consuming their music, it's just a swipe away. It's right there. You know, it doesn't interrupt the flow. That does make sense, doesn't it?
Well, also, what's very interesting is that we had our recent story on TikTok and Apple Music, where TikTok has been testing direct links to
exclusive.
Yes. I know, which sounds like amazing reporting. And you realize actually it was just someone on our team spotted it and told us, and then we took the glory. But so I think that's another part of DSP trends I see is it that we're going to be these links between social media and specifically short video and streaming are going to become more direct. We're going to have more sense of exactly how short video drives streams. That opens ways for advertising. Like someone, when we published that story, one of the things I saw on Twitter was someone saying, this could be really big in terms of, as a label, my willingness and ability to invest in TikTok advertising. Because if I can track properly the streams, then that's huge. And then I've got an ROI. So I think that's one of the things where the more direct links we see between social services and DSPs, that's going to be a shift for marketing budgets. And
it's probably the most exciting time in sort of recent memory around DSPs, isn't it? Because there is this sudden differentiation of approaches and a willingness to try new things in order to deliver experiences to fans in new ways and deliver money back to artists in new ways. And I think we're going to have a very interesting year in the next 12 months and just seeing how that plays out, you know, and what I think when we have this conversation again next year, which we will, I think we'll have a fundamentally different environment. One final thing then, Stu, we talked about buzzwords earlier in the show around AI, which has supplanted the buzzword du jour, the previous one, which was Web3 and before that NFTs. Of course, I don't want to toot our horn too much, but we sort of predicted that this is how the bubble would go and we would then sort of go through the hype cycle of up the long slope of productivity around Web3. And we're sort of seeing that, and Web3 is making some very interesting possibilities happen around streaming, isn't it? Like we think of Web3 like as buying an NFT, which is a JPEG or a GIF, but that's old hat. And we're finding ways of Web3 music being a thing. So how does that fit into this sort of burgeoning DSP space?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like there was that period of Web3 equals NFTs. And I think we saw some of the streamers, we saw Spotify experiment with NFTs, letting some artists promote them. Yeah. We've seen YouTube CEO last year was talking about we're looking at NFTs carefully. So I think there was a sense of like, this thing is happening and we're going to see if it makes sense to be on our streaming service. But yeah, like you're right, Web3 is about decentralization, it's about communities, about transparency, it's about NFTs, but it's also about tokenizing stuff and all kinds of things. And so what we have is we have big streaming services cautiously dabbling a little bit. And then we've got companies like Audius is the obvious one, and Napster, and then a whole raft of Web3 music startups doing different aspects of it, who are sort of saying, well, what is a native Web3 service? If we're building it for this news, these philosophies, these technologies from the ground up, what's it going to be? And so we've got this kind of this moment of, if Web3 is the next leap forward for the internet and internet technologies, which, you know, is for all the hype and the things that have gone not so well, the general thrust seems to be towards that. It's that enduring question of, can the companies made for the last generation adapt? Or will new people come through to dislodge them? Like, will we have, you know, was Amazon arguably Web 1.0, wasn't it? It was the big winner there. It came and it disrupted traditional shopping. And then Web 2.0, Facebook was the big winner from that and it disrupted MySpace. So in a musical context, I think we're thinking, well, is something like Audius going to be a Spotify rival? And you see a lot of these breathless articles from random bits of the crypto blogosphere saying, such and such blockchain service is a Spotify killer. And you go, yeah, but what does that mean? It's not killing Spotify. It's not going to kill it in 2 years. That's a silly thing to say. But
yes.
So the bigger question is, if we're in a Web3 world in 2-3 years time, how are the current services going to adapt? And is there space for a new player? Is there space for an Audius or an Appster to come through and become a big player? And I don't have an answer to that question, but
I have a tentative answer to that question, which is, it feels to me from talking to people that there's a possibility that we sort of see, I'm going to use the word bifurcation of the industry in that sense, where like making existing catalog backwards compatible with Web3 platforms is going to be really difficult because it requires so much, you know, buy-in from so many different parties. But if you're a new artist now and you're saying, right, I make these this music at home on my laptop, and there's a reason, by the way, a lot of NFT Web3 powered music is electronic. It's made on laptops, right? Because it's probably one person making it at home. They own everything. And they say, right, do I want to go down this path where I put it onto traditional streaming platforms and get royalties on a pro rata basis? Or do I want to go down this path, or both? They can do, they don't have to choose. They can go down both. Or do I sort of want to go down both, but prioritize my attention around the Web3 music space, which is about nurturing support from the initial super fans, generating income in new ways that are not just about selling tokens, but maybe selling fan club like elements or getting people to buy something around a song, which means that they're supporters and they get extra stuff and they're closer to me. Now, if I was an artist starting out and I'm like, well, if I put stuff on, if I upload my stuff to traditional DSPs, it's statistically unlikely it's going to blow up and make me a lot of money, but it's going to be a really good way of uncovering new fans and bringing people in. But over here on the Web3 music space, where I can decide from a sort of a menu of innovative ways of engaging with people financially, whether it's ownership of bits of songs or whatever, you know, then I can bring people in and create this community that's about give and take around money and access or whatever. That I can understand why people want to do that. They might not make a lot of money either way, but at least on one of them, they feel like they're in control of their destiny in that sense. And I think that, so we might see all the music available everywhere, the quote Web3 music available on traditional streaming platforms, but we might not see you might not see Fleetwood Mac's back catalog being Web3 music enabled.
So maybe Web3 becomes the parallel music industry, or even like it becomes just another level of music industry that is focused on direct fan stuff. So
it's Pi 2.0. You mentioned about growing the pie, and this is where you don't need to grow the pie. You just grow a new pie.
That's it. You're growing a new pie. But it is interesting. And so that makes sense that you're going to have a layer of the industry, which is recorded music, streaming, mainstream social services. And you have the layer that is fan communities, super fans, musician. And then I suppose then the cynic's question is, does that need to be Web3? Do you need to NFTs, or is this just fan clubs and mailing lists and actually doesn't need to be this stuff until this stuff proves itself? So I think, but it's why, like, even though the hype came up and now the backlash is in full swing, I still want to write about lots of Web3 music startups and lots of these, because I think they are doing interesting things and they're figuring out this new layer, this parallel industry that's going to be important, and how soon it happens and how it interacts with the existing services is meant to be seen. But yeah, it's still, for all the kind of the bad stuff that happened and the terrible NFTs, it's still a really fascinating thing. And I think a lot of the smart people in the music industry haven't given up on it. They're still experimenting and they're still following it very closely. So as are we.
Yes, exactly. Well, Stu, it's been a pleasure as always. Music Ally subscribers can check out the full quarterly report. There'll be a link below the podcast for them. If you're not a subscriber, you can check out how to become a subscriber, or you can hop across the website and read our extensive coverage on all of these things in the news section. And I encourage you to do that. But Stu, for now, thanks very much, as ever.
Thank you.
All right, there we go. A big thank you to Stu, as ever, for downloading all of that insight into our ears. And if you found that useful, please share the podcast on with someone else who you think will get something out of it. If you're a Music Ally subscriber, you can access the full quarterly report via the link below the podcast. And if you want to get in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. Email me, that's joe@musically.com, joe@musically.com. If you'd like to stay in touch by having emails land in your inbox every Friday afternoon, you can get our free weekly email called The Knowledge, which rounds up all the bits and pieces of everything that Music Ally does, which includes analysis, news, marketing insight, and skills, and so on. So sign up by the link that is below the podcast as well. There you go. Thanks for listening. I've been Joe Sparrow. You've been you. And until next time, farewell.